Report. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. 7 o'clock tonight, Will Owens, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Trading places with the Canada-U.S. trade relationship still shaky, to say the least. Prime Minister Mark Carney is making new deals with Germany. Our guest says since neither country can count on Donald Trump, they need to count on each other.
And he reigned supreme. 50 years ago, the late Ron Turcotte rode the now legendary horse Secretariat to racing records that have yet to be beaten. And he still loved the sport even after a life-changing injury. A longtime friend tells us who Mr. Turcotte was in and out of the saddle.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE in a few moments. Our weather for tonight, clear skies, lows in the low 50s, mostly sunny tomorrow, high 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny and cooling off a bit with highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Grand Rapids Riverfest is coming up 1 week from Saturday. We'll see you Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. We are going to listen to one of those artists now. Alan Sparhawk came out with an album earlier this year, paired with Trampled by Turtles. A song from that album, this one's called Stranger.
Thank you.
That's Alan Sparhawk featuring Trampled by Turtles. The song's called Stranger. And you can see Alan Sparhawk Saturday, September 6th at Grand Rapids River Fest. Right next door to KAXC, we'll be at the Grand Rapids Area Library Amphitheater. Find tickets and more information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Alan Sparhawk will kick things off at 3 o'clock. Then we'll have music from Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, and Courtney Barnett. We hope to see you there. Also, every week, you can look for the set list. It's a look at live music happening throughout the region. You can find that at KAXC.org in the latter half of the week and listen for it on air as well.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
a Freund in Need. Prime Minister Mark Carney wraps up his visit to Berlin, and a former German politician tells us that now more than ever, it is crucial for Canada and Germany to be bosom diplomatic buddies.
Making a federal case out of it. As wildfire threats grow across Canada, so do calls for a new national agency, an aerial firefighting service. We'll hear from an NDP MP who is pushing for both.
Easy Rider, a longtime friend, remembers Ron Turcotte, the Canadian jockey who expertly rode to fame on one of the greatest horses in racing history, Secretariat.
You can't spell pool without its first three letters, but no one wants that stuff in an actual pool, which is why a Finnish city is so troubled by the emergence of a serial pool pooper.
Fork over the dough. Tens of thousands of anguished fans sign a petition to save the uniquely Quebecois version of The Simpsons. The actor who voices the lead character says this hits close to Homer.
And they'll reveal a lot if you handle them with finesse. Tired of fish being viewed as lesser vertebrates, a scientist explores their hidden emotional depths and finds they don't just feel fear or stress, but pleasure as well. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that knows girls just want to have fun. Prime Minister Mark Carney has been busy in Europe. He's in the midst of a five-day trip around Poland, Germany, and Latvia, forging deeper trade and defense ties as he goes. Today in Berlin, he met with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, after which the two leaders announced a new critical minerals partnership that could deepen the link between the country's supply chains. Here's part of what the Prime Minister said during their joint press conference.
We're moving from a world where there's exposure to vulnerability. The vulnerability and instability is, I think, the norm in the global economy, global geopolitics. But countries like Germany, Canada, partnership with the European Union, can provide stability and prosperity for our citizens. This partnership provides a rock and a foundation for that shared prosperity.
Mr. Carney went on to say that the new deal will help Germany reduce its dependence on Russia. Bernd Altusmann is a former German politician with the Christian Democratic Union Party. It's Chancellor Merz's party. He now runs the Canadian office of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, a think tank in Ottawa, and that's where we reached him.
Bernard, when you listen to what Prime Minister Carney was saying on his trip, what do you take away from those words and those promises?
In uncertain times like this, you need friends and partners, and Canada and Germany are reliable friends, allies. We share the same values, and the German-Canadian partnership is more important and valuable than ever.
This is all certainly about signaling strength and unity to the United States, but also, of course, to Russia and China. And in terms of those two countries, we'll start with them. Do you think those two countries, even with a critical minerals deal like this one, do you think those two countries care?
I think the global order is shifting, and multilateralism is maybe weaker than ever, and multipolar competition is intensifying, and critical minerals, critical infrastructure, common challenges in security and defense against the Kring states, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, is important for our common security in Europe, but also in North American continent. Looking to the Arctic, the potential field in the near future for conflicts, there we have the common interests to secure our northern flank of NATO together with Canada, with Europe, and with Germany. And it's not by accident that in these days we discuss how we can, or how Canada can, strengthen its own maritime sector, submarines, and the Arctic sector in the near future. And therefore, Canada and Germany can work very, very close together. And when the U.S. president said the Europeans are the first line of defense, yes, the Europeans will be the first line of defense, but we need, in the second line, good partnership between our allies. In this case, the most important allies beneath the Americans is Canada.
You mentioned the new submarines. Ottawa, for our listeners who may not have seen that the announcement, Ottawa said that Canada is down to two bidders for building new Navy submarines for this country. ThyssenKrupp in Germany is one of them. Another is in South Korea. When you look at the potential for a deal like that, and also, you know, the other meetings, the other announcements, the kinds of words and language being used, I mean, how would you compare the relationship between Germany and Canada at this moment to even just a year or 2 years ago?
From my point of view, readiness and willingness, the ability, capacity, that are the crucial factors. Canada and Europe, and especially Germany as the strongest economy, have a rooted in, or we are rooted in, shared history and common values of democracy and decades of cooperation, and remaining as one of the most stable and successful alliances in the world. Now, we, especially in Canada and the European Union and Germany together, have to invest in defending themselves. We have to look that we are operational readiness of Canada and also German forces. That is in our common interests.
Do you think announcements like the ones we saw today, not just in Germany from Prime Minister Carney, but also in Latvia, as we've said, about extending our Canadian troop presence there, do you think that that can actually do anything to make a ceasefire a reality, or even get the talks to a better place?
If it is necessary to have a key peacekeeping mission for the next year and peace for the future, every one of us hopes for that deeply. We are really, everyone in Germany, in Europe, I think in Canada, is hoping that this ceasefire will happen. But the first step is the end of fighting and aggressive Russia against the Ukraine.
The critical minerals deal, though, as you well know, is not binding. There's no financial commitment attached to it. So are you confident that it's actually going to hold this deal, and the promises that were made are going to come through?
Very often in the past, we heard from different prime ministers, chancellors in the past, promises, announcements. Remembering the hydrogen and also the LNG deals of the past. And at the end, we need action. We need that this comes to action. And my hope is that this agreement now between Canada and Germany will come to effect as soon as possible. And we have to work on that very hard. And as I know, Chancellor Merz, he will work very hard on that to bring this to reality, because critical minerals are sort of highest importance for the industry in Europe, in Germany, but in Canada and everywhere in the world as well. And only relying on China, and to hope that they will also deliver for the future, that is a failure. And therefore, therefore Canada now will come more into the focus of the world as one of the leaders in energy security, and LNG and critical raw materials.
Bernard, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. All the best. Take care.
Bernd Altusman is a former German politician with the Christian Democratic Union Party. We reached him in Ottawa.
bien. En plus, le monde de Boston est tellement prétentieux. Ils sont sûrs que leur maudite ville a les meilleures affaires de toutes. Meilleur groupe, meilleurs humoristes, meilleure soupe. Ils disent que c'est des tartes à crème, mais ils font avec du gâteau, pis...
If you live outside of Quebec, you probably don't recognize that voice. But that is Homer Simpson. At least it's Homer Simpson as voiced by actor Thierry Dubé on the Quebec version of The Simpsons, Les Simpsons. Now, that dubbed version of the show isn't just different from the English version. It's different from the French version that airs outside Canada. But now that Quebec version is at risk. Télétoon, the television network owned by Corus Entertainment, did not renew the broadcasting rights in Quebec for Les Simpsons. And since Corus was responsible for dubbing the show, that could mean the end for the beloved Québécois version. We've reached Thierry Dubé, the voice of Homer Simpson, in Montreal.
Thierry, this story is certainly getting a lot of attention, well, certainly outside of Quebec now, but when did you find out that this was going to happen?
Oh, we did learn it about a week ago, that negotiations between Télétoon, which is owned by Corus here in Quebec, and Disney, which owns Fox, which owns The Simpsons, we learned that their negotiations didn't went through, and so that Télétoon was removing all Disney things from their catalog, so they're not basically broadcasting neither The Simpsons, Family Guy, or American Dad. Those three series had strong French-Canadian versions, and now they just disappeared.
For our listeners who, you know, they just heard a little bit of a clip, but they haven't seen maybe your version of The Simpsons, it's not just in another language. There's much more that makes the Quebec version of The Simpsons popular and beloved. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that is, what makes it so special?
Yes, of course. Well, it's a cultural phenomenon, the same as it is for the rest of the world and America, North America, for instance. But from the start, 36 years ago, when they adapted the series to the French-Canadian language, they made it really, really Québécois. So Homer and all the family speak with a strong street-talking French-Canadian accent. And everything was kind of localized. So every time they're having a guest star on the show, or they talk about a politician or an artist or a singer or whatever, an actor, the writers always made sure to put that, to transpose it to French equivalents, to Quebec's equivalents. So we have our own reality TV stars and singers, and then so it became very, very local, very, very Québécois, which is kind of a, I know it sounds bizarre, but as American as The Simpsons are, because it's so localized, a lot of Québécois, French-speaking Canadian, identify to the series and to the character, because they made, for instance, my character, Homer Simpson, they made it being that regular Québécois from a suburb and speaking in a Québécois language and have all the cultural references that we do share in Quebec.
So there are so many iconic lines from all of the Simpsons characters, but especially Homer, of course. How do you go about, for the last 8 years, tackling that? What are the, you know, he says dough, obviously. What do you say?
Yeah. I say dough. I say when in English he says my little. We translate it to a mon petit verre, and it's made in Quebecers' language and sentences. Yeah,
it's interesting it's fascinating as well on a number of levels, because the fact that the show, the creators of the original Simpsons, would not object to those kinds of changes as well.
They would actually love it. They actually loved it. I know that Matt Groening, which is the creator of the series, when it started, he listened to a lot of them and said that his favorite international version was actually the one from French Canada, because it's like a hybrid between the original voices, but at the same time, very, very localized. So it's kind of a hybrid product that everybody adopted.
So there are about, last we checked, 20,000 signatures on this petition to save your team's version. Yeah. The cabinet minister has weighed in, Ian Lafreniere, calling the references in the show, quote, sublime. So does that give you hope that, Disney is going to actually take you guys on and pay for this and keep keep it going?
I always want to be hopeful. So I hope that it's just a matter of misunderstanding. And I think that probably people deciding at Disney on the higher spheres are not aware of that cultural difference and how important it is to people in, Quebec. Because a lot of people say, well, you'll still have access to a French version. It's going to be the one from France.
Oh, I'm sure that went over and well.
it's totally different.
Yeah.
Homer in the French version doesn't have the same voice, doesn't have the same expressions, don't talk. Well, it's a very good version, actually, but it's very localized for people in Europe. The way I'm maybe your listener would relate to it is, imagine for a moment, everybody knows The Simpsons. Imagine, for instance, that it would not be possible for Canadians anymore to listen to the original one. The only way you would be able to listen to The Simpsons would be to have a localized United Kingdom version with their way of talking and their way of having that regular Homer being that regular Joe in England with those expressions and everything. You guys would just couldn't imagine it. But it's the same thing for us.
8 years is a long time to spend on anything, let alone a character like this that has so much connection in Quebec, as you've said. So can you imagine your life and your work without Homer?
I don't want to imagine this right now. Like I said, I'm someone which is positive and hopeful, but I cannot imagine it. For me, it's a nonsense. As long as the version will last in the United States, and I think we should be able to have a French-Canadian version. My dream would be for Disney to include it in Disney Plus. I think it would be a great incentive, and it would ensure that we still produce the French-Canadian version.
Thierry, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much.
Thierry Dubé is the voice of Homer Simpson in the Quebecois dubbed version of The Simpsons. We reached him in Montreal. This moment from 1973 lives on in horse racing history. The Thoroughbred Secretariat winning the Belmont Stakes and the Triple Crown by 31 lengths, a record no horse has beaten since. And the jockey who rode Secretariat to those victories was Ron Turcott from Drummond, New Brunswick. 5 years later, he was paralyzed from the waist down in a riding accident. That ended his career, but not his life in the sport. He continued to travel on the horse racing circuit, talking about Secretariat and raising money for other jockeys who'd suffered life-changing injuries. Ron Turcott died last week at the age of 84. There will be a memorial in his hometown of Drummond, where there's a statue of him and Secretariat, and Grand Sioux Falls, New Brunswick will be lit in Secretariat's colors of blue and white. Leonard Lusky was a longtime friend and business partner of Ron Turcott. We reached him in Louisville, Kentucky.
Leonard, that moment that our listeners heard from 1973 is, you know, unforgettable for them, for those who were there at the time and saw it happen or saw the Disney movie about Secretariat. But I wonder for you, when Ron, you know, what do you remember about when Ron first entered your life?
Well, I mean, I watched that race. I was 13 years old, and I watched it on a 3-inch black and white television. So I would say he entered my life then. I just didn't know it. I was as enthralled and amazed by that 31-length victory as anyone could be. And, of course, it just all is a part of the mythology, I think, of Secretariat. So when I met Ron and person in the late 90s, you know, I was meeting one of my heroes growing up here in Louisville, Kentucky. We sure love our horses,
yes,
especially our Derby winners. So, yeah, to meet him, it was amazing.
They always say don't meet your heroes, but you challenge that old adage.
That's right. And just from the start, I mean, he and I very much hit it off. He was always about telling the story, getting people interested in the sport, and so accommodating and so gracious with his time and his energy. And that really just began a quarter century relationship that only got better with time.
What do you think made him such a good jockey?
Well, I think there were several things. Obviously, I think his physical makeup, he was so strong. When you were introduced to Ryan, he would have this bone-crunching handshake. And you would go, wow, I didn't expect that. But I think what his real success was based upon was his intuitive nature on what a horse needs to be guided, and when you let the horse guide you. And I think that was particularly true with Secretariat. He had had that historical background in being a lumberjack and in timber, and they had used horses, draft horses. So I think he had this innate feel of horses and what they want, what they need. And that really helped him once he became a jockey. And I think not all jockeys have that. The best ones do, and he was certainly one of the best ones.
What did he tell you about... It is such an important relationship. I mean, the best jockeys, I would imagine, really have a deep love for the horse that they're working with. What did he tell you about Secretariat?
Well, he said he was so intelligent, and we had some great stories that he told me, personal stories. I mean, when I would ask him about a race, you know, tell me about the Derby. Of course, he could say, you know, we were in last place, and I let him take his time. And it was great to know that sort of education on the race, basically, an insight. But what I really loved was when he would talk about his personal interaction with Secretariat, or the stories you don't normally hear. And one of the great ones was whenever he would see Secretariat in the barn, Secretariat would stick his tongue out, and he would grab his tongue, and it was kind of like an affectionate greeting. Ryan would grab the horse's tongue, and he said, all the way into retirement, the horse, whenever he would see him, would stick out his tongue, and he would shake his tongue. That was just one of the many stories he told.
You've also talked about that handshake, but also you used the phrase that unmistakable swagger to describe
yes.
him. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, you know, Ron, he had this quiet confidence. I'm sure, again, it came from his accomplishments in the sport, but I think it also came just from his situation in life. He had overcome a jockey's worst fear, and I think that Ron was able to navigate that new adversity and come out with just this great attitude of gratefulness. He was never bitter. He always said he was the luckiest guy in the world because he rode Secretariat, and you felt that. And when he came into a room, and especially like his fellow jockeys, he was the benchmark of success. They didn't look at him like, oh, you know, I feel sorry for you. They were as awestruck as anybody else, especially the young generation. You know, this is Ron Turcotte. He rode Secretariat.
And he worked with other jockeys who'd suffered life-changing injuries, helping them. That work was important to him as well.
Exactly, because, you know, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund was one of his really big cause-related supporting organizations that he loved to help. Ron had the measure of success. He really was in pretty good financial spot, but 99% of the jockeys that get hurt don't have that luxury. And he understood that. And he understood that as opposed to the NFL or the NBA, where they have kind of organization that with pensions and insurance, jockeys were independent contractors, kind of on their own. And if you got hurt, well, there was nothing really for you. So this Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has just truly been so important to those who have gotten hurt on the racetrack, and he was just such a great advocate.
I can tell you're really proud of your friend. When was the last time you spoke?
So we spoke just really at the end. It was a goodbye conversation, and we both knew it. But and he wasn't feeling well. But I got to make him laugh, and it was great to have that, you know, have that last laugh with him.
Leonard, I appreciate this. Thank you very much for your time and our condolences.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it too.
Leonard Lusky was a longtime friend and business partner of former jockey Ron Turcotte. He's also president of Secretariat.com. Exercise Center, Oulu, Finland. Matti, the pool technician, has been maintaining the municipal pools in Oulu for years, but this is his last day before retirement. It's been a great career, free of any trauma that will haunt him for the rest of his life. But then, as he's doing one last skim, he sees it. He screams and faints and wakes up and screams again. And on his way to call the police, he does something he's never done before. He runs next to a pool.
Oulu Police Department, Gross Crimes Division.
Officer Elsa Niemann is looking at her one-way plane ticket to the Bahamas. The end of her shift, she's officially retired. She's humming Kokomo to herself when the Sarge arrives at her desk, his face ashen. He hands her a stack of crime scene photos, and her heart stops as he says the words every cop dreads. Someone pooped in the pool again. This is the real-life nightmare facing the city of Oulu, Finland, and specifically the people who run the Linnanmaa pool. Children's accidents have been ruled out. That has happened in the past, the manager of Oulu's municipal pools told Finland's public broadcaster. This clearly involves an adult. A grim conclusion indeed, particularly because this adult has soiled the pool six times since the start of July, meaning they are dealing with a serial pool defiler. And now authorized pool staff have the thankless task of going frame by frame through weeks of CCTV footage, seeking the person common decency should prevent me from calling the poopetrator. But don't get mad at me. Let's focus on the real villain here. We'll keep you posted on the search for the arch nemesis of community and decency responsible for a crime that is deeply, or shallowly, disturbing. Here's Sahara with Indoor Pool. Indoor pool.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, an MP makes the case for a national aerial firefighting force.
Plus, a scientist says fish feel pleasure. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you for listening to KAXC and As It Happens. Good evening. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Will Owens is your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Support comes from Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country, lakecountryjournal.com. Mostly clear tonight, lows in the low 50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny, high 75 to 80. Slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, a bit cooler, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. The Friends of Lake Bemidji State Park have a pancake breakfast this Sunday from 8 to 10 at the park's dining hall. Bring your own plates and utensils to help the environment. And let us know what's happening in your communities. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. There's more ahead from As It Happens.
It's been another scary, near record-breaking summer for wildfires. For months, emergency services across provinces coast to coast have been dispatched to try to control out-of-control burns. And now some people say the wildfire threat has grown too severe for Canada's current response systems. They're pushing for a national fire administration and a federal aerial firefighting force. Gord Johns is one of those people. He's the MP for Courtney Alberni of Vancouver Island Riding, where wildfires are still burning. We reached him in Port Alberni.
Gord Johns, I know you've been out in your riding, talking to people, seeing how they're doing. What is the latest on the fires and how people are coping?
Yeah, so I had the fortune of going out with our provincial forest minister yesterday and at least flying over one of the biggest fires, you know, the Mount Underwood fire, and just seeing the scope of the damage and the impact on our ecosystem, on, you know, infrastructure. It's devastating.
Earlier this season, you know, I spoke with people who in the aftermath of wildfires in different parts of the country, but, you know, volunteer firefighters were telling us, you know, there just wasn't the kind of backup we needed. And the first responders you've been speaking with, I mean, do they just, what are they telling you? Because the sense I was getting from people I've spoke to earlier was that they want better training, they want better support, but is this kind of federal administration what you're hearing they want?
Well, I think there's two things. We're hearing, you know, from the Canadian Association of Fire Chiefs, the need for a national fire administration to support the collaboration and strategic coordination that's necessary for major emergencies and ensure that the efficient use of resources is there, and also to integrate fire and emergency management. But we're also hearing that they need equipment, that a national aerial wildfire response capacity is needed federally. And, you know, without a national air tanker fleet right now, each province has to weigh out the cost of purchasing or contracting aviation resources, for example. And there's no guarantee that resources will be available when and, you know, where they need it most. And, you know, other countries, they retrofit their retired military aircraft for aerial firefighting. They provide rapid response capability that supports national resilience. And what we've been calling for is the government to convert their retired military aviation equipment, like the CC-130H Hercules fleet, that can be converted into state-of-the-art air tankers. This is really important. Also, we could do this under our NATO commitments and serve Canadians at the same time.
The federal government earlier this summer, as you know, announced nearly $46 million in funding to fund wildfire prevention projects across Canada. And after that announcement, Eleanor Olszewski, the federal minister for emergency management and community resilience, was a guest on our program. We'll play for you and our listeners a little bit of what she had to say in that conversation about this idea of a national fire administration.
You know, one of the things that I'm, myself and my department are looking at this point in time is whether what we do needs to be much broader than that. That's not to say that we don't need to focus on wildfires, because we do, but there are a number of other kinds of natural disasters that this country faces, including flooding. So one of the things we need to look at is whether whatever we establish needs to be broader in scope. Although, having said that, all of the options that are available for consideration are being considered at this point in time.
Why not have a body, Gord Johns, as the minister is suggesting, that would look at fires but also flooding?
Absolutely. Like every year, you know, fire or flooding related disasters are growing in scale and severity. They're devastating homes and communities in nearly every province across the country. And, you know, we're unlike every other G7 country. Canada still lacks a centralized national body to lead and coordinate fire and emergency safety policy efforts, leaving, you know, fire and life safety issues in a blind spot. And that's why a National Fire Administration for Canada is not just an idea, it's a necessity.
But are you on board if it were to be a broader mandate, that if it was, you know, more about broader emergency preparedness, not just fires?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, right now, like I'm in fire season, and I'm seeing firsthand the damage and the impact on, you know, on the ecosystem. This requires a wartime effort.
You tabled a motion back in June pushing for the creation of this kind of National Fire Administration that we've been speaking about. Based on what you heard there from Minister Olszewski and what you're seeing right now, are you getting a sense that you're closer than you have been before to getting this body?
Well, I think that the body is one thing, and that is really important. And I hope that they will listen to the Canadian Association of Fire Chiefs, honor the motion that I presented, but also this idea that I've been bringing around a national aerial wildfire response, capacity mechanism that could be in play to support, you know, provinces and territories when they need help. Both need to happen. I'm on the front line of the climate emergency. I've got burning wildfires on both sides of my city right now. 2 years ago, our highway was shut down on and off for months because of another wildfire. So we're seeing a record amount of wildfires on Vancouver Island. In fact, this is the second largest fire we've ever seen. This is something that's close to home. And people in our community are saying, we need to do more. The federal government needs to do much more.
What do people there need most right now? Because as you've said, the wildfire season is certainly not over. The burning on both sides of you, as you said. What do people there need most right now?
Well, right now, I mean, in my community, it's different. It's unique. The road to Banfield, for example, has, been impacted because of, loose debris and material, trees that are burnt and could release at any time if there was, any sort of amount of precipitation that could wipe out the road and put human life at risk. So they're cut off. People can't even get home or out to the community. It's all by boat or an alternate route that is very difficult to navigate. So it's impacting business. It's impacting the people that live in that community, get access in and out. And, so right now we need to get that road back up and running. You know, we had heroic efforts by BC Hydro personnel. People came off holidays to help at least get hydro to the community. They were completely cut off. So this is what can happen when wildfire happens, is that communities can be completely, isolated with no power and no access. So, the faster we can, mitigate the impact of a fire, and having a national fleet of air tankers, a state-of-the-art fleet to protect communities, critical infrastructure, is really important. And that's something that I'm going to continue to push for and continue to work with government on, and all levels of government. And our needs are that we need to see the federal government take our proposals seriously and to take action.
Gord, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And thanks to all the people across Canada that are supporting communities that are facing wildfire, and especially those wildfire fighters that are on the front line.
Gord Johns is the federal MP for Courtney Alberni. We reached him in Port Alberni, BC. When we last talked about pigeon birth control on this show in November, it was a time of hope. Not, overall wide-ranging hope, of course. But when it came to pigeon population control measures in the city of Toronto, there was very specific hope that contraceptive food in feeders around town would be the key to humanely curbing the pigeon boom. Esther Attard is the city's chief veterinarian. At the time, she told us, hopefully, that if all went well, quote, we should see a 50% reduction. But it didn't all go well, and the pigeons are as plentiful as ever. Ms. Attard spoke to David Common on CBC Toronto's Metro Morning today. He asked what had gone wrong.
It didn't go wrong. I think we just learned a lot. So we started, it was a small pilot project that we wanted to try. And we heard about a product that could possibly help us control a pigeon population. And so we set up some feeders on some roofs and started to feed the food. But there were some challenges with keeping the feeders going, with being able to take photos of the birds to count them. That's how we were going to see if it was working or not. And then we had to train the birds to come up onto the roofs to feed where they were feeding on the ground before, because people feed them all the time. So that was challenging, because if they're being fed already, they may not want to fly up to a roof to eat the food we want to give them. And so those kinds of things. And then construction took over at some of our sites, and that scared the birds away. So we learned a lot of things during that pilot. So it wasn't a complete failure at all. But it is something that we want to continue to try, because we're looking for humane methods to manage animal populations in the city. So we're still going to continue on a small scale. We've got a feeder now that feeds on the ground, so that's easier. It delivers the food on the ground, and that way we can train the birds to the ground feeder and in areas where we know we have issues.
Were there some challenges in execution as well? Things like batteries not changed in the feeders, so they weren't working, and things like that?
Yeah. So, and in when it got cold, things like that, even though we wouldn't be feeding the ova control when it's cold, because the birds aren't breeding when it's cold, you still have to keep them coming to that feeder. So you still want to be feeding them cracked corn or things like that to keep them coming. And so sometimes that wouldn't work. They would get, full of food and it wouldn't deliver the food the way we wanted to. The cameras wouldn't work. So those kinds of things meant we had to do a lot of attending the site, which became difficult. These feeders are more robust, and so they shouldn't need as much maintenance, and we shouldn't need to be there as often. And hopefully we're hoping that that will work better in our climate.
From her conversation today with David Common, host of Metro Morning, that was the City of Toronto's chief veterinarian, Esther Attard. Humans have a tendency to anthropomorphize. We make all kinds of assumptions about our dogs, including that they're good boys. We attribute a certain too-cool-for-school mystique to our cats, when really they're either just asleep or waiting to be asleep. We even assign personality traits to hamsters, which are only ever thinking about running on their wheel or stuffing food pellets into their cheeks. But then there are fish, genuinely mysterious and unknowable. When we see them in an aquarium with their unblinking blank eyes, we don't tend to give them personalities. But some researchers believe fish have inner lives. And now they say there may be more going on behind those glassy eyes than we might assume. Marta Suarez is a behavioral physiologist at the University of Porto and a co-author on the study. We reached her in Lisbon.
Marta, you and your colleagues feel that fish are generally misunderstood. What are most people missing?
Most people think of fish as almost like an inferior vertebrate. And in literature now and studies usually focus on the negative side of things, like, which is important, of course. I'm not saying it's not important. But research is more focused on, do they stress a lot? Can they eat better? Do they feel things? And so I think we are going on a different direction towards what is positive, and can they change behavior when the stimuli are positive instead of just aversive or negative?
And you're suggesting from your research that fish do feel good.
Yes, that's the idea. The general idea is that the benefit can just be because it feels good, as you can, as you would look at any interaction between maybe primates or humans. Well, we do things because we benefit from it, of course. I mean, if you think of grooming between primates, mm-hmm. they want to have their parasites removed naturally, but they also do it because it's good, and it because it's it, yeah. it makes you feel closer to other individuals, and fish can also do that.
You took a look at two species of fish in particular. Yes. Tell us a little bit about how you carried out this research.
I should define first that I've been working with the cleaning mutualisms for a long time, mm-hmm. and these mutualisms entail relationship between two individuals or two species at least, where one removes parasites from another species that cleans them for food. And the benefit in one species is, well, food, and the other one is to get rid of the parasites. So that's the definition. And these interactions are very widespread. You can see, I mean, in literature, in marine, but also in other aquatic environments. So you can see this happening in a lot of environments, but in the coral reefs are really prevalent. And you can also see that these cleaners have their own stations, as we call it, territories where they are visited by other species all day long.
The blue streak.
Yes, including the butterfly fish mm-hmm. is one of them, mm-hmm. from dozens, hundreds in that case.
So you see that behavior, and then you need to figure out, you know, what are the reasons they're doing it. So how did you test that?
Beyond cleaning and parasite removal, they also touch each other, right? And we know that those that visit and get touch, they have their stress decreased. We did this in the lab. In the lab, we don't have any parasites, so we thought, okay, what is feeling good? And you can basically dissociate the feeling good into liking and wanting. And then we did two different experimental designs where we test that. We ask, do they like it? Do they like to be touched by a cleaner? And how bad do they want to be touched?
So you have the blue streak cleaner rasa, and then you have the threadfin butterfly fish, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Then you inject the butterfly and fish to try to find out about what kind of pleasure they're feeling and if they're feeling it, right?
First, we wanted to see whether there was differences in behavior. And we did find out that if we put any fish interacting with a cleaner fish, the animal, they would prefer to stay in the place where they interacted before with the cleaner. It would work like a happy memory. Then we ask, so there's a difference in behavior. Do opioids change? Is it true opioids? And opioids are related to liking, enjoying, right? And so we injected the fish, yes, with an opioid that would increase the activation of the pathways. And we saw that that preference, that in memory, would increase with the opioids.
What was that like for you to see that?
It was really interesting. So it kind of demonstrates what I imagined, which is things are socially more interesting and more complex than most people think.
There have been some researchers who said that they're not sure that what you observed can really be described as pleasure. You've seen those comments, I'm sure. What do you say in response to that assertion?
Well, I would expect that, because pleasure is a word that you could do this. You could do this simple experiment with a primate or with a dog or a cat, and then you could say that. You could say, oh, they like it. And why do they like? They like to be touched. It's because they feel pleasure. So it would be just natural to say that, right? But for a fish, I understand that is more complex, and I understand that. And so, I mean, I can talk with you and say that any other species we could say that, but maybe for fish you can just say they like it. And then in the second experiment, what we tested, by the way, I'm just going to continue on, we tested the want part, the motivation part. So we just put little doors and obstacles, and the fish would have to circumvent those obstacles to get to a cleaner. And just the behavior there was similar. I mean, they would be interested in circumvent those obstacles to get to the cleaner. So the like and the want existed, but then the opioid system would not be involved in the similar way as the like part.
Beyond expanding, you know, understanding more about what fish can do, what they feel potentially, what do you hope comes of your research?
In large, I think it's the fact that we are focusing on the positive. It's the fact that we are demonstrating at least animals or fish can change their behavior with a positive stimuli. You don't need to be an affliction or an absence of food or anything more negative. I mean, just the fact that we are demonstrating that fish can really have a preference and that they like something. So maybe you can change the idea, the notions around it, and you can maybe change the way fish are treated in aquacultures and
not just changing, so, not just changing minds, but changing the way you conduct research.
Yeah. But I understand that this is difficult, and what I do, I mean, the idea for me is just to bring another little step to knowledge is enough. But yes, of course, changing the way people look at fish and giving another more demonstration to those that work on welfare and need this data, need these studies to have things change.
Marta, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're interested in our work.
Marta Suarez is a behavioral physiologist at the University of Porto and a co-author on a new study of fish, which was published earlier this month in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. She's in Lisbon. Then I'll throw in Beethoven's Fifth, followed by 2 minutes of Seagull Calls, and I'll end with a song of pure triumph, Rude by Magic. Perfect. Oh, hi. I'm just working on a Spotify playlist for one of my cat's birthdays, but you can listen to it too. By default, Spotify playlists are public, and you can tell a lot about a person from their playlists, which is why a 23-year-old engineer built a bunch of bots to scrape the listening data of all kinds of high-profile Americans. He has now published the results on a site called The Panama Playlists. What can we learn? Well, buckle up. First of all, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance's Making Dinner playlist includes Justin Bieber's One Time and the Backstreet Boys' I Want It That Way. That's hard to fault. More concerningly, though, weather presenter and TV personality Al Roker exercised his freedom to listen to Elton John's Philadelphia Freedom 151 times over the past year. Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi's taste ranges from Nelly to Rick Astley, which reveals possibly something, but it's hard not to see some symbolism in two of imprisoned cryptocurrency fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried's favorite songs, Unstoppable and Blindsided. Two New York Times tech privacy journalists were also exposed by the bots, proving that anyone can get tripped up by defaults set to public. Those journalists subsequently confirmed with many of the subjects that the information was correct, while others declined to answer or denied the playlists were even theirs.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.